Let's roll. This is Countercharge, your podcast for all things Kings of War. Join your hosts Rob Fanoff and Mark Zielinski as they delve into the world of Mantica and bring you in-depth coverage of all things Kings of War.
Welcome to Countercharge. I'm Jeremy Duhall.
I'm Alex Chavez.
And I'm Rob Fanoff, and we're back again to go inside the List Builder studio, and we had to get the guy that everybody was been clamoring for us to bring in, Alex Chavez. Alex, how are you doing tonight?
I'm doing very good. Pleasure and honor to be here. I'll do what I can to live up to that reputation.
Jeremy, how are you doing this evening?
Doing pretty good. I'm in the post-con recovery phase from KubleCon. So a little sleepy, but I'm doing good.
Real quick, what have we been doing in the hobby? Obviously, Jeremy, you're coming off of KubleCon. How'd that go?
It was a lot of fun. We had a really good turnout for the Kings of War events. On Saturday, we had our one-day tournament, and we had about 10 people show up, which for us is still pretty good. We're building the scene. It was a three-game tournament. First two games, I did pretty well against Abyssal Dwarves. We had half the field was Abyssal Dwarves, which was kind of funny. And then I went up on the top table for round three against Steve from Rough Rider Wargaming. And he smoked me. We were playing the Eliminate scenario, and his army was all shooters and siegebreakers. So he gave his tokens to his shooters that stood behind his siegebreakers in a corner. And I was playing my undead, and I just had no answers to that, so I couldn't even get close to killing any of his units with the tokens. So he beat me pretty bad, so I ended up finishing third place, but still pretty happy. His list was pretty good. And then I think the night was probably the coolest thing. We had an 8-man free-for-all mega battle going on. And then at that same time, we were running a Kings of War school demo night. And for the demo night, they had 3 or 4 full tables, and then we had 8 people playing in the mega battle. So for Northern California, it was the biggest, most people playing Kings of War at one time in the history that we could figure out as far as Northern California goes. So we were pretty psyched.
What have you been up to, Alex?
Hobby-wise, I haven't been doing that much recently. I'm working on a display board for Mountaineer. It's something that actually looks pretty good as opposed to some tray I took to Masters. And then hobby, like gaming wise, kind of we've been playing every Thursday night at a local store here in Northern Virginia where we live. I'm getting about 4+ players per week, so it's been pretty good building the community here, kind of trying to get more interest and more players that kind of either heard about Kings of War or wanted to get dabbled in Kings of War, interested in playing the game. So I'm working on that, and I'm kind of not really hobby wise, but I'm working on a new army as well here, so I'm kind of testing some Empire of Dust, which I'll hopefully bring out sometime this year.
Interesting.
So the Mountaineer, that's going to be a fun event.
Yeah, that should be a lot of fun. I'm really, really looking forward to that. Like I said, I'm trying to build a display board so I can actually get, I know there's going to be some really good painters here, but I'm looking at least respectable and put together. But should be a lot of really good competitions. Some out-of-state people coming in. I know some Southeast players coming in, from what I understand, at least one or two that I've heard of, and Northeast guys as well, so it should be a good mix of different metas and a good mix overall.
I think George is done with you, though. I don't think George wants any more of you.
I don't know. I'd be happy to play him anytime. I think eventually he'll figure it out, right? Maybe the third time's a charm.
Why don't you start us off with, who is Alex Chavez?
Oh, yeah, sure. So I've been playing Fantasy Gorm 4 games for quite a bit here. I think I picked up Warhammer Fantasy, that other game, back at around 4th/5th edition. Really didn't play it seriously until I'd say about 6th edition. 6th is when whole Ravaging Horde came out. I played a lot of that into 7th edition and played a lot as well. Didn't really hit the GT scene at the time. I was kind of a broke college kid, so I couldn't really travel to all these events. I wanted to, but I made it to one event here and there. But I had a lot of fun doing that and playing that. But then when 8th edition kind of rolled around, I kind of took a step out of the scene. A whole gaming group that we played with here was kind of a group of about 6 to 8 guys here. We kind of all tapped out around 8th edition. So kind of took a break and then and picked up again when Kings of War came out. So I've been playing since then and been having a lot of fun. You know, kind of got addicted to the GT scene again here. So I'm doing as much as I can now that I have the disposable income to do that.
Yeah, and whereabouts are you from? I know you're from, what, Northern Virginia?
Yeah. So basically right outside D.C. It's a suburb of D.C., Northern Virginia. I live personally in Fairfax, which is basically about 20 minutes outside of Washington, D.C., considered kind of a suburb area there. I'm pretty much living here my whole life, so that's kind of the gaming scene. The people I know have been in this area.
Awesome. And I know you got some other, you got any shout outs to any of your club mates? I know Mike Austin's a pretty good player.
Yeah, Mike is great. Mike Austin's great. We got another Mike Atkins has recently moved to the area. He's playing. He's a really good player too. I expect him to be kind of coming out of the GTs as well. Have a really good crew. I have a friend, Steve, that we play with as well. Like, have a really kind of tight knit group that we play a lot of games with. So I think our scene here is not as big as some of the other scenes, but we play a lot and we practice a lot against each other. So we kind of challenge each other and get better that way by doing a lot of basement gaming and whatnot. So, you know, like I said, recently we've been playing it to the game store and trying to grow it up a little bit, but you got to start somewhere. I think we started in that basement level kind of practicing against each other.
What armies do you play?
Right. So right now I pretty much just played Dwarves. I dabbled with Abyssals a little bit. Played a 1200 point tournament just kind of for fun. It was Clocks of War style events, but primarily I've been playing Dwarves for about a year and a half, a little bit over that. I mean, pretty much since the second edition came out, I've been pretty much going straight into Dwarves and playing them ever since.
Well, I think we're ready to go into the List Builder Studio. Are you ready, Alex?
Yeah, absolutely. Let's do it.
Jeremy, are you ready?
I'm ready.
The List Builder Studio.
Okay, it's time for him to join the elite. The best of the best entrance into the List Builder Studio. So, Alex, when you're thinking about starting a new army project, what draws you to the army first? Is it the models, the army play style, or what kind of sparks that initial desire to start a project?
It's definitely a great question. I think it's a good mix of kind of a few things you mentioned there. To me, first and foremost, it's always going to be theme, personally. I have to play an army, I have to be excited about it. I have to really kind of look at the models and the feel of the army, kind of like I spent a long time picking the right models I want to, the right figures, that making sure that it looks the way I want it to look. And that, to me, the essence kind of plays into essence and play style as well. So I want to make sure that the army is not going to be something boring. One of the main reasons to talk about Dwarves that I went into Dwarves in the first place is that I think that Mantic took a really interesting take on Dwarves, adding things like monsters, adding things like the cavalry that Dwarves didn't have from the other game. And I've always liked Dwarves, but I never played them for exactly that reason, that they didn't have those other options. They weren't multifaceted like they are now. So the, you know, theme is by far one of the biggest things I look at in an army. I want to make sure that it works the way I want it to on the battlefield. You know, otherwise, why bother playing? You know, you could play a video game or something like that if you don't really like the look or the push of the models.
Well, touch on that a little bit. You mentioned you like, you know, to consider army theme. You know,
yeah.
How do you use army theme to build your list?
Sure. Yeah. So, I mean, when I look at theme initially, for example, my dwarf list is very, I call it very mountain dwarfish. It's kind of got snow. It's got some, you know, kind of old school. I don't want any like really fancy theme stuff. I want it to be very bare basics dwarves. My list right now is kind of got a lot of elementals. It's got the cavalry that I talked about. I love the Baroque Riders. So I knew I wanted some of those elements in my list. I mean, I kind of start from there. So I know I'm going to have a few units of those. You know, I knew I was going to have a few as a cavalry. I was going to have a few monsters. I wanted at least a greater elemental or two in my list. And then from there, I kind of play tested. I put on the battlefield and I kind of let, you know, the playtesting process continue, where I kind of figure out what units are working, what's not, what combinations are working, what's not, and then I go from there. But, you know, I definitely will play with a couple of lists. And talking about, like, let's say, for example, Empire Dust, which I'm looking at now, you know, I like the theme of the army. I'm going to have chariots in my list. I know I'm going to have, you know, a monster two as well. So, like, I kind of start with that, and then I expand the list from that. So I kind of pick 2 to 3 units I know I really want and I really like, and I kind of expand the list from there.
Cool. And when you're kind of, you know, you're kind of getting ready to do a new project, you're getting excited. Do you look for anything for inspiration? Like, will you look at a movie or an art image? Or sometimes, like when I'm picking a color scheme, I try to find a colored image that's going to kind of inspire my color scheme or my theme for the army. So what about you when you're thinking about a new project? Do you get inspiration from different aspects of the hobby or pop culture or whatever?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I think, you know, when it comes to Dwarves, I don't know, maybe I watched too many Hobbit movies or something, but I definitely like had that outside of my mind of like, yeah, that would be cool. Like I want, you know, Dwarf Riding on Board, whatever he's doing. You know, I wanted something there. I know with Tim King's, for example, or Empire Dust, should say, you know, I love the old Mummy movies. I watch things like that. I'm a big kind of history guy as well, so I look at things like, you know, Egypt history and how does that tie into it, or you know, maybe Viking, whatever the case might be. I'm definitely big into history and kind of, you know, I want that theme to carry over in the army. I want it to look cool, and I want it to kind of, you know, the point of the army is to kind of what I have in my head, put it on the battlefield and kind of play that way.
So when you're building a list, Alex, do you have any foundational concepts that you use? Is there these certain trick or certain technique, something that you always go to? This is what I, you know, have to consider when you're building a list?
I think there should be a general overall strategy. Absolutely. I think otherwise it's going to be a little bit disconnected from the army. I think it's kind of harder to play that way. But I think in general, it's good to have an overall theme or strategy. For example, my dwarf list, I think that it's a pretty classic kind of hammer and anvil strategy where I have, you know, I have some fast, hard hitting units and I have a very kind of slow, tough army that kind of is the anvil. So you know, I think that when you're playing, no matter what, you need to have, every unit needs to have a role. You need to have a very specific purpose to the army. Otherwise, it's going to get kind of lost, I think, or you might not do as well against, you know, someone that is prepared that way.
Yeah, I know some people, when they're list building or they're designing a list, they'll kind of build it around smaller components. They talked a little bit about this in the last episode of List Builder Studio, which is really good, about thinking of your army in smaller combat groups. Does that kind of come into your thinking at all when you're building a list? Is how are these individual components within this army going to work together and then work with the whole force?
Okay. I think this might be a little controversial, but I don't actually believe in groups at all. I really disagree with that concept in general. To me, my army is one group. I have a group, and that's my entire army. And I think that when you build the army, like I said, there's different roles. It's very important to realize that there's certain roles you need to fill in the list. But I don't look at certain battle groups. For example, if I'm deploying a certain flank where I want, you know, unit of cavalry and then a character with them, like, I don't do that every game. And I think it's important to not bottleneck yourself into that certain role where you're stuck doing that every time. You know, one game I might put two units of cavalry on the flank. One unit I might put just a monster on the flank. Let him hold that. It's very important, I think, to be flexible and react to your opponent. And for that reason, I don't like to look at groups at all. I pretty much always deploy my army differently based on my opponent. I very rarely will do the same deployment twice against a certain player.
That's interesting. So when you're looking, are you thinking instead of combat groups, are you thinking more around the types of things you want to have in your overall complete list?
Absolutely, yeah. I think it's important to establish, like I said, those roles that you have. So, for example, I need a unit that is going to be threatening and also able to take a charge. You know, those are my anvils. They're going to walk up there. They're going to threaten objectives. They're going to threaten, you know, shooting, whatever they're going to do. They're going to go up there. They're going to establish a presence. And then maybe on the flanks, I'll put my speed on there. Or maybe, you know, maybe in this game, I'll put my cavalry in the middle and I'll threaten them. If they give me an opening there, I'll definitely go for that. I think it's important to have enough of balance between the roles that you know. You want enough speed in the list that you can still, you know, too slow and you can't react to the opponent. And then you want to make sure you have enough of that, you know, sort of slower, heavier units that you also can kind of, you know, react to the opponent as well. You don't want him to just kind of steamroll your middle of your army and kind of just open you up from the inside. So I think it's very important to establish the roles that you need. And you know, you need to have certain aspects of your list deal with certain threats. I think it's very important to play the meta and play the threats that you might expect and kind of have an answer to those. I think that's a huge part of list building, just kind of roles and answers.
Yeah, he brings up a really good point, Rob. I think so many people build in combat groups that I wonder if in building in that way, if you become a slave to those groups and you can't during a mission or a certain scenario that you really should deploy a different way, an instinct is to not do that because you're like, okay, this is my left combat group. This is my middle combat group. This is my right combat group. And you just can't like pull, you know, you got to pull away from that, but you just can't do it.
The people that are good with this, using combat groups, they are actually able to understand what role each of these units play in the combat group and are able to basically change them up on the fly, right? You know, this group needs a little chaff. This group needs a source of inspiring. This is the combat, the hitty block. This is the, you know, I don't know. Certainly, what you're saying is you could get into I think it could be a problem is if you, in your mind, you have a, you know, let's say three combat groups in your 2K list and you always play them together. Well, there's certainly going to be a scenario where that probably wasn't the best way to play it. And also, you know, Alex brings up a good point. You know, you may be short selling yourself. It's the battle groups are just a piece of the army. But if you're not looking at the entire synergy of the whole army, you may be missing out.
Right, and I think that's important to establish when you need to be flexible. You need to be able to adapt to what your opponent's doing. So, you know, let's assume every army has a shooting element to it. You need to have targets in mind when you're shooting. You can't just put them down and like, okay, this is my center group. And you know, that's why I like shooting elements that can kind of be flexible and fill multiple roles, you know, kind of chaff shooting, because they can move out and shoot. You know, let's say I want both my shootings on the right flank, and then I'll be able to kind of take care of that fast cav threat there. But if you put, you know, your heavy cavalry on the left flank, I'm not going to put my shooter units there. I'm going to put them away from that. So I think it's important to be able to break down your groups and to have, you know, so when you have inspiring sources, you know, you want sources that can kind of be flexible and kind of go with different groups, different setups. I mean, like I said, I probably have 20 different combinations of you know, groups, if you want to define them as groups the way you would for other armies, like, you know, and I think that's important, though, because I think that you need to be able to adapt to the opponent. And that's kind of one of the most important things about Kings of War is adapting and being able to adjust your army based on what they're doing and what the scenario is, those kind of things.
Well, let's jump in and talk about chaff.
Yes.
You know, do you have a set number of units of chaff you like to include? Do you include anti-chaff? Just, you know, how does chaff affect your list building?
Chaff definitely affects your list building. I think if you don't have chaff, you definitely need strong anti-chaff. My list is very interesting, and I don't know where we're going to do the breakdown of it exactly, but I don't really run what I think people consider chaff units. But what I do instead is I definitely run anti-chaff. I run a couple of units of rangers that can deal with you know, chaff from a distance. And then I run very tough units that I can throw into chaff and then not really care if you get the charge on me, because, you know, I was expecting you to charge me anyway, so I'll just take out your chaff and then not, you know, you have that much less points to deal with my stuff. So I think chaff is good. Chaff is definitely important, but you need to have a plan either around it or to use chaff better than chaff, so you can take out theirs maybe with not taking as much damage, or you can then get objectives, things like that. Definitely need a battle plan about that. I think it's probably the most important thing is to keep the scenario in mind. So, like, for example, if your army is really slow, then you need to be able to game plan around, let's say you're paying pillage, like, okay, well, you need to look at like 3 to 4 objectives and say, okay, well, I can't win them all because he has more units and more chaff than I do, but I can win these 4. So I know I can win the game if I can win these 4. You know, if you're outnumbered, then you definitely need some sort of game plan around killing those units. You know, I don't really like chaff that are too expensive. So once a chaff, I think it's over 100 points, I think it's too much. I think some of the better chaff units in the game are really quick and really cheap. I think that's kind of the two main factors when it comes to good chaff.
What's the best chaff unit in the game?
I'd say gargoyles easily. To me, it's not even close. they're priced at, I think, 80 points, and their speed is unreal. They have the regeneration, so if you don't eliminate them in one go, they're going to heal all their wounds back. I think that they're far and far away one of the better chaff. I think also up there is like things like beast packs, ghouls. You know, stuff that's just really cheap and you don't have to worry too much about it.
I think you bring up a really interesting point, which is the duality nature of dealing with chaff, which is I'm going to arms race. I'm going to have chaff too. So no matter what my opponent brings, I'm going to have chaff. Or realizing that your list doesn't need chaff, but you have elements on when I do face chaff, how do I deal with it? So it's not just like you have no idea what to do when all of a sudden your opponent has 7 chaff units or whatever. You have an idea in your head is how am I going to deal with this specific element of my opponent's army?
Absolutely. Yeah, that's a very good point. And that's, for example, things like war machines. I don't take war machines on my list because I don't have chaff and I can't. You know, I don't want to put something that's very susceptible to chaff, and then war machines kind of fit that role. So, you know, you have to go one way or the other. You have to either say, okay, we're getting chaff, we're getting at least 3 units, we're gonna have stuff to deal with them, or you say, I'm taking none chaff, and I'm taking, you know, stuff that isn't vulnerable to chaff. You know, if I don't like that big a deal, so you just kind of play around that.
So when you're list building, when you're, you know, you got your theme, you have your inspiration, you're now getting down to actually building the list. Do you have a certain kind of sweet spot of number of drops you want to reach? Is it just, does it change? Does it vary? Or what do you think you need to be at drop wise?
Yeah, absolutely. I think drops are very important. And it's right now I'd like to, I see most lists 11 or 12, I think is a good number to be at. I think that if you're above that, you kind of have a more, you know, Kaffir or a more Horde style army, which is fine. I think below that, it's a little too elite for me. I think there's a lot of inherent weaknesses you have to overcome. If you have below 11 drops or so, I think that's kind of a struggle. So I'll build lists and I'll kind of have roles. But if I build a list and I look at, I only have 9 drops or 10 drops, I kind of start over and I kind of scratch it. So, you know, I kind of make sure that I'm hitting those benchmarks when I build it.
No, I think that's a good point, because I think ideally you try to want to build a list that can do well in all scenarios, you know. And I've known my undead list has been 10 drops, and I really feel when I, you know, it's a weakness in some matchup, it's a big weakness. So I think you're exactly right. I think, I don't know what Rob thinks, but I think the 11, 12, 13 range is where you really need to be drop-wise.
Yeah, I think it just depends on the army. 11, 12, 13 is probably, for me, would be kind of the bare minimum.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think 15 plus is awesome too. I think, you know, it's as long as you just have that bare minimum, I think you're okay. I mean, I know that with the new unit strength too, talking about Clash of Kings, there's kind of a bare minimum you want for that as well. You know, you probably don't want to sit below, I think, about 13, 14 unit strength. That's really low. I don't know if you can, most of us can get that low, but, you know, there's definitely those things that you just need to, like, look at your list and you kind of make sure that you're checking those boxes off. You know, do I have more than 10 drops? Do I have at least, you know, 14 unit strength, kind of those things? And then, and as long as you check that off, and that's kind of, the way I look at it is like, okay, that list it's got those boxes checked out. It doesn't have any inherent weaknesses that opponents can exploit right off the bat.
Well, why don't you touch on it? You mentioned it. You know, scoring units, unit strength. How does that impact your list building?
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I think I probably had a more knee-jerk reaction than most people when I thought the unit strength came out. I kind of thought, okay, well, like, monsters are going to be crap now. Dragons will be crap. They're still fine. I think those units are still good. I think, like I said, you just need a bare minimum of those unit strengths, because, I mean, the thing you got to consider is that unit strength only works on, I'd say, at most half the missions that are even, it's relevant, you know. The only ones that's really going to matter are things like invade, control, you know, those moves where you're moving a lot. And for those, if you kill opponent's army, you're still fine, regardless of how much unit strength you're going to have. So I don't wait as much as I used to, you know, if you asked me 2 months ago, but I think that it's something that you just want to have at least, you know, that's at that 14 mark. You know, as long as you're there, you're okay no matter what.
Cool. So looking at dwarves, you know, it is has some slower elements. In this sort of list, and also just in your general list, how do you think about speed? How do you think about flyers? How does the power of mobility in Kings of War, how does that stuff kind of put its seed into your thinking when you're getting ready to list build?
Yeah, so I think speed is by far, do the most things with speed. Just have the most threat range. You have the most ability to have the opponent, you know, dictated and kind of have them answer to you. So I think when it comes to speed, and usually speed comes with flyers, it's kind of come hand in hand. You have to have either a way to deal with them, or you have to have a lot of them in your army. You know, I talked about dabbling into abyssals and the abyssal list. I think I'm running, you know, six to seven flyers in that list. I mean, I think that's very, very powerful to have speed on your opponent, because it means you get to dictate where the battles take place and makes you take the chances of who's fighting who. So, having said that, my dwarf list is actually very slow, but, you know, it still has speed elements to it. So I think that, you know, at the bare minimum, you need to have, you know, I'd say at least 3 to 4 units that are very quick and can at least threaten, you know, units and threaten zones. You know, you want to have a threat range where your opponent can't walk all over you. So I think it's very, very important to you know, realize that effect in the game right now.
And kind of like how you were talking about chaff before, are you thinking about not only how do I want flyers or how do I want speed in my list? Are you kind of thinking about, okay, when I go up against those 3 Alohi hordes, or these fast werewolves on the flank or whatever, are you trying to think about, anticipate how you're going to deal with those fast units while you're list building?
I think definitely like those kind of lists you need to have answer to. And like I said, it's kind of ironic or hypocritical, because I'm actually, my list is probably most weak to those style lists that are very quick and have a lot of quick threats to it. But that's the thing right now that I think is sort of the meta right now that's tough to beat is very quick elite list that can sort of a glass cannon style that hits you very quickly, that, you know, they're not necessarily that tough, but they, when they pick combats and they pick combats right, they're going to punish you. So you need to have some sort of answer for that in your list building in general. you know, that's something that you just need to keep in the back of your head. I think that you can't, someone with flyers can't just run all around you, around all over you, you know, certainly yeah. something. That goes into, I think, meta building as well. Like, the same thing when it comes to shooting, right? You don't want a list that just gets shot to pieces in two turns. You know, you want something that has either the speed or toughness to stand up to shooting as well.
Yeah, well, I think one of the great things I like about this game is that the more I play, the more I see that the more balanced list you, the gimmicky or kind of a one-shot pony, it will work some of the times. But if you don't take into account all these little nuances that we're talking about, if you're looking for that list that's going to perform well in the aggregate, you know, over the long term, you're going to run into these issues.
Oh, absolutely. I think it's by far the best-selling point Kings of War has, is that it's actually a balanced game and that it rewards balanced list building. You know, really, I've always been a fan of balanced list building, even back in some of those crazy Warhammer days when it wasn't necessarily the best idea to do balanced list. I always did it just because I thought that that's when army should, you know, I kind of talk about theme, the army should be balanced. It should have different answers, but, you know, it didn't always work that way. But even still, in this game, you actually do get rewarded for it. You get rewarded if you plan ahead and you know, kind of plan things to work the way you want them to, the game does reward you for that. So that by far the best-selling point of the game is that there's a lot of strategy, even though it doesn't seem that way from maybe if you look at it initially.
And, you know, these mass combat games, I think, are about spectacle. And we talked a little bit about this, about kind of this new genre of hybrid games and miniature slash card slash token games coming out. And when you think about it, the most visually appealing fantasy armies to me are the ones that would translate as to being balanced in their list. You know, you have some infantry, you got your shooting guys, you got some cav, you got this, that, and the other thing. Those to me, not only are they balanced game wise, I'm visually looking at the army. That's what appeals to me the most, is what I would imagine a traditional, or imagine what a fantasy army would be in a fantasy world. It would have all these components.
Right. Yeah, I agree. Well, right. You're not going to have like six monsters on the list and that's it. You know, it's just going to be a mix of infantry, cavalry. Yeah, you just want this general army, and it should look that way and it should feel that way. And I think that's definitely the most fun games I've had are when I'm like, yeah, this is a real battle. That to me is the best part of the hobby. Yeah.
Well, Alex, you're inspiring my soul by all the cool stuff you're saying. So why don't you talk about inspiring in your army? When you're thinking about inspiring, is a set number of sources? Are you thinking about, talk a little bit about how you view inspiring as it should play out in your list building?
Sure. Yeah, I think inspiring obviously important. You know, you need at least, I'd say, 2,000 points. You're gonna need at least three, ideally four, sources of inspiring. It's a little trickier now. I know we talked about unit strength earlier being a factor. You know, inspiring most commonly comes on individuals who don't score anymore, and so I think there's a little less value in individuals than you had pre Clash of Kings, which I think is a good thing too. I think individuals were something that had too many answers, maybe too many rules. So I think that now I take three inspiring sources in my 2,000 point list. And as long as you plan ahead and you play it right, then you're fine. It's okay to have a unit not inspire. I think sometime you don't have to go overboard because then it can be a waste of points. But I think generally, as long as you have three, you're good.
Yeah, I wonder, just kind of bring up a really good point, is the idea of, I know some people in my group, it's the goal is to have every unit inspired every turn, every phase of the game, every single thing you have is inspired at all times.
Right. And I've had that mentality at one point, I'd say, too. And I think realistically, if you're doing that, you're not being efficient with your units. I think that's not, there's no way you can do that at an efficient point level to say that you're, you know, getting all the offensive threats you need while having them all be inspired. Sometimes you just need to send a unit out there and kind of hold, you know, either you know, put them in behind some terrain and kind of let them hold where they wouldn't otherwise, or you just need to send a unit way out the flank and let them deal the combat and hope they win. And if they win, great. If not, you know, that's fine as well. You know, you can't really cover the whole battlefield at once, I think.
I think it speaks to what you were saying earlier about being adaptable and reactive to what you need to do based on the situation that you're facing. Because maybe in a game, it's smarter for you to split up an inspiring source with the unit and not keep them together for whatever reason based on the scenario or however the game's developing.
Absolutely. Yeah, I think that's exactly that. That's how I play the game, is I don't necessarily think, okay, I need to get this character that inspired them. I think know, where's the character's most useful? Is he gonna, is he better off disordering that unit, or if he's better off, you know, charging something else? And I'll do that. I won't. You know, if that exposes me to a little risk, you know, you have to manage risk. I think in general in this game, that's part of managing risk is thinking where do you need inspiring, where you don't need inspiring, and you have to, you know, sometimes say no to that answer. You don't need inspiring there, and then just go without it.
So what do you think about? I know they have it with the in dwarves with the spellcasters. What do you think about units that inspire only specific things? Are the stuff that gives, it's just blanket inspiring? Does that kind of come into your thinking at all?
Yeah, absolutely. Actually, and the thing is, some priests you're talking about, they're actually only inspiring for earth elementals, for example.
And then,
for example, the Berserker Lords only inspire the Berserkers. The Warsmith only inspires War Machine, those kind of things. I mean, they kind of dictate how you build your list in a lot of ways because, you know, if I'm having a stone priest, you don't really get that much bang for your buck if you only have one unit of elementals, you know, then that inspiring becomes kind of useless. So you kind of have to play the list as a whole in the sense that, like, you know, I have a stone priest, I'm going to have at least, you know, three units of elementals, whether they're greater elementals or just regular horde or regiment, something like that. If you have a berserker lord, for example, you're going to want at least one or two units of either berserkers or brocks or something to inspire. You know, you don't really want to have them kind of sitting around units they don't inspire. So you definitely have to keep that in mind. I think when you build the list, in the current one that, you know, we'll get to here in a minute, that I have one stone priest and one berserker lord, as well as an army standard bear. So I have one sort of catch-all inspiring and then a couple of situational ones. So, you know, I think it works pretty well in general, as long as you're sort of smart and plan ahead a little bit.
Yeah, we'll get to that later. I mean, I have post-traumatic stress disorder from the mounted berserker Brock Lord. So we can talk a little bit about the shenanigans that guy can do. Oh, man, what a great character. But so when you're thinking about magical artifacts, now I know some people like to, hey, I got five extra points, blade flashing. Done. Bob's your uncle. Let's move on. Whereas I know for me, werewolves, you got to have them with Brew of Strength, or I just don't think that they function as well as they can. So when you're looking at magic items, artifacts, is it an afterthought? Do you kind of consider it almost an extension of the unit? You're getting it no matter what, like Caterpillar on Heavy Cav, you know. Talk a little bit about kind of your thinking on magical artifacts.
Yeah, sure. So I think magic artifacts, I think they're amazing in this game because if you're not paying too close attention, they seem they're kind of like an afterthought or like an after unit like that, like you talked about. But if you use it correctly, artifacts really change the role of a unit a lot. And that's the artifacts I like to give, is the ones that make my unit different. So, for example, if you have a unit that is kind of medium hitty to a plus one, you know, Brew of Sharpness, something like that, then you've turned that unit to just a total hammer that can now annihilate your enemy. If you take a heavy cat, give them Caterpillar, you know, they're now a completely different role in your army. They're now able to kind of, you know, run right through woods and charge at full speed and not really care. And I think those items that are worth investing in, the ones that kind of change the roles of units quite a bit here. There's some items, like, for example, the Loot of Insatiable Darkness, I think is a really, really good item. So I think that you'll see that in most lists nowadays, if not every list, probably one of the popular ones. I think Banner of the Griffin's a really strong list or item. Sorry. I think it makes units really, really strong. Like, you know, just able to, the units are a little bit different, more tanky than they would be otherwise. So, you know, it plays into their strengths. It plays into the roles that you have. You know, I think I'm very much a role oriented at magic item list. It shouldn't just be 5 points here, throw in an item, 10 points there, throw in an item. I think that that's into the cost of the unit.
Yeah, you know, I completely agree with you because I've been running a lot lately since Clash of Kings came out, the zombie legion with the hammer of measured force. Because all of a sudden, you know, 40 attacks hitting on fives, always wounding on fours no matter what. That greatly changes where I'm going to put the zombie legion. Now the zombie legion's not just in the middle, it's I'm going to put it in front of whatever your best defense unit, most expensive unit is. Because I just know through weight of dice, wounding on or doing damage on fours, that like you said, that item changes the dynamics of that unit.
Absolutely, it's a great example. I mean, you've turned your zombies into a unit that I can only ignore, into now a serious threat. So I have to deal with them differently, and that's what you want. You want your opponent to look at your unit differently. with the magic artifact. That's kind of the important thing.
He's like what you're saying, Earth Elementals. Oh, you're going to flank me with a zombie legion, 80 attacks. I don't care. I'm going to take like 4 wounds. Because you're hitting on fives, wounding on sixes. I can just sit here and I can tank your whole legion. It's not a big deal. But all of a sudden, with that magic item, the dynamic of that encounter is completely changed, both in what I plan and then also, like you said, in your reactive thinking, is what am I going to do in this situation? That artifact changes both sides of that matchup, the my thinking and then also your thinking, the opponent's thinking.
Absolutely. And it's important to realize that too. Like sometimes, let's say you put the hammer on unit and I end up avoiding you and I kind of, you know, you don't end up doing that much damage. The fact that I'm reacting to it is already the value of the item. You know, you don't have to necessarily do great things with that item. As long as your opponent's reacting to it differently, I feel like you've already gotten value from that item. And that's, you know, whether it's plus one speed on unit that otherwise would be a little bit too slow, they can now do, you know, threaten further things. Like different things your opponent reacts to. That's how I look at magic artifacts. Is that you want your opponent to react to it, and if they don't, then you know, even better, then you get to do what you want with them. So that's kind of ideal.
Yeah, because I think a lot of Kings of War, in essence, it's peace trading. So if I can influence you to trade me the piece that I want you to trade me for whatever I want to trade for it, if I can force you into having to do what I want you to do, which sometimes avoiding units causes, okay, you want to avoid this hammer of measured force. Okay, the only way I can avoid it is I'm going to go over here and get surged by Wraith in the rear or whatever the situation is. You know, you can really kind of try to influence your opponent. So kind of wrapping up the artifact section, when you're thinking about how many do you, will you just kind of take a lot, take a little? Is it really dependent, like we talked about, is how artifacts influence units? I know some people go completely naked and they just want to put bodies on the ground. I mean, what do you think about the amount of artifacts you like to take? I mean, does that kind of enter into your thinking when you're list building?
Right. So I think the amount of artifacts is not as important as like the, at least the roles. So I've had lists where I take 2 artifacts, I've had lists where I take 0, I've had lists where I take 5 or 6. You know, it really comes down to, as long as you have the units you want and the roles you want, you know, that's important. So I think they're kind of an afterthought. You know, I look at a unit of Brock Riders that are naked versus a unit of Brock Riders with Cavalier. There's 2 different units. So, you know, I want one of those on my list. I might not want another one on my list, you know. So it's kind of like, that's the way I've always looked at them. It's like they're 2 different units. And then that's the important thing to list build is like, which one do you need? Do you need the one with Cavalier or do you need the one that's naked? And then kind of build your list around those units.
Or maybe like if your Brocks have Brew of Strength, you might treat them a little differently, knowing that, okay, well, if they lose their Thunderous, it's okay. I can, you know, they'll have a pip of Brew of Strength. They'll still have some Crushing or, you know, whatever those, like you said, that artifact is slightly changing how you may play that unit.
Right, exactly. I can turn my cavalry into something that's a little bit more sustainable, something that can countercharge a little better. You know, I don't have to necessarily sit back with them and kind of wait for that perfect charge. I can kind of throw them out there, knowing that as long as I survive the charge, I can countercharge with that extra strength. You know, it's a little bit different unit than you know you're used to. So, you know, I do like, those are great examples of items so far. I think that they kind of make that impact. Like Hammer Measured Force, another good one. You know, things like that really make a difference.
So you've talked a little bit about kind of like, I think you're kind of starting to get a sense of your play style, being an adaptable player, a reactive player. So how does that come into your thinking when you're thinking about deployment? Do you have principles of, okay, this is how I would ideally like to deploy? Are you deploying completely reactive based on how your opponent deploys? Or how does kind of pre-deployment methodologies or ideas, how do those kind of influence your deployment?
Okay, so definitely scenario is the most important thing. So you have to kind of plan your army around the scenario. My army in particular, I'm a pretty slow army, so I kind of have to put a unit down. I kind of have to look at their next 4 to 5 turns and think they're going to end up around there, because if I don't, otherwise they're just going to be out of position every game because they're just not fast enough to get where they need to be. I think with faster armies, you have a little more leeway where you can kind of redeploy, or you can kind of move around quicker, so they're a little bit better at that. But I very much think, okay, I'm going to kind of take this scenario, whatever it may be. I'm going to have to, my unit's going to end up around there, so I need to put them, you know, in a position where they can get there in 3 turns or 4 turns, whatever the case may be, you know. And then from there, you play on what your opponent plays. So if I put my unit here and then my opponent puts a unit across from me that's maybe too strong, then I need to put, you know, some support nearby there, either whether it's like, you know, a chaff, or if it's a character nearby that can kind of help support as well. You kind of have to play from that angle and kind of react to what they do on, you know, making sure I can win the flanks versus, you know, making sure, or I can make sure I overpower his center so strongly that he can't overwhelm me on the flanks as well.
I think you bring up a really good point about sometimes what I'll do is I'll have like a loose running points total. I think a great thing about Kings of War is how balanced it is. I mean, it has its maybe bell curve, under overcosted slightly units, but in general, it's really balanced. So I'll often sometimes think in my head, okay, left flank, my opponent's got 700 points, give or take. Oh, look, I only have this 200-point unit on this side. And then that will give me kind of a quick sort of easy way to think about, okay, where do I need to react to where he's deploying? And then also, too, I'm curious, sometimes do you just abandon a flank? Like you said, okay, this flank is gone. I'm just going to play flank denial on the other flank. I'm going to make sure I take the left and middle. I'm not even going to worry about the right side because he's already deployed. Are those kind of things kind of percolating in your brain during the deployment phase?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you said it well. Like, you can very much look at like a math equation. Like, if he's got 700 points in that flank, if I can put 300 points on that flank and maybe say stall him out for, you know, four turns, something like that, then I'm going to win somewhere else, right? Because I should be having, you know, his advantage there. So I think part of deployment is knowing where you're strong, where you're weak, and kind of deploying it, you know, not just like give it away to your opponent, but kind of play into that as best as possible. Say, okay, that I can, you know, win the middle or win the flank or win, you know, the scenario that's kind of, you know, blazing the scenario as well, then you kind of do okay. You know, you just kind of have to make sure that you come out ahead when that formula comes to fruition, whether you know, you're really aggressive in some spots. And that's why I think things like speed are so important, because you need to be aggressive. You need to be aggressive quickly. You know, you don't have time to, if it takes me six turns to beat you on the left flank, that doesn't really matter, because I just, you know, I don't have time to punish you elsewhere. I don't have time to surround you. But if I beat your left flank in two turns, then all of a sudden I have units now, you know, look at the side of your army or the rear army in positions where you may not have answers to them yet. And you know, that's kind of the general battle plan I'll play, is I sort of hammer in, well, I'll win the flanks, hold the center, and kind of make sure that I surround you in with enough time to kind of punish you for it.
Yeah, and I think you bring up a really interesting point, like in allocation, investment, and allocation of resource, right? So if you think of a spearman unit, it's a bunch of cool spearmen, but it also has a value in the game, right? This unit is worth this amount of points, and that means it should net X result, right? So if you have a 400-point unit that I'm tying up with 200 of points, you're investing 400 points to kill 200 points of my army. That means someplace else I have a 200-point advantage over you in some other element of battlefield.
Exactly. And if you use that right, if you've built blitz right, then that advantage should translate into, you know, winning. Essentially, the primary goal with winning flanks is to get those flanks and rears that it takes to kind of bog your enemy down. You know, there's plenty of times where I'll you know, I won't counter, if I'm in a defensive frame piece, I won't even counter charge opponent. I'll just say, okay, well, instead of counter charging you and letting you counter charge me back and kind of, you know, get the advantage of not getting hindered, I'll just sit back and let you charge me again hindered and kind of stall as long as I need to. You know, I think it's important to have to realize when you're winning and losing.
No, that's a really interesting point of the I could charge you, but you're in a woods and I want you to have hindered with my, let's say you're charging with an anvil unit, not a hammer unit, and your whole idea is to try to hold that unit for as long as possible. So you won't charge. And then there's times even where I don't even like to counter charge with an anvil unit, because I want you to recharge me again and again have a hindered charge, if my goal in that moment is to just bog you down for as long as possible.
Exactly. That's the difference between lasting one more turn, and if I countercharge you, I'm not gonna, if I can't wipe you outright, it would, like I said, if they're an anvil, they're probably not gonna wipe you outright. So it's sometimes better just to back up and maybe put the opponent in a position where if he charges you, he's not gonna kill you and he's gonna end up in a worse spot where you can open up your own charges, you know, setting traps up. You know, you have those famous corkscrew charges that everyone loves that you can, you know, deal with fancy charges, things like that. You know, it's very important when your battle line needs to be very organized and kind of planned accordingly.
Yeah, you know, you can think about sidestepping, backing up, so that when that guy charges you again, maybe he'll align to you in a way that will then give you a flank charge in the next turn. You know, so it's not always the perfect thing to do a counter charge. But,
exactly. Go ahead.
Sorry. No, go ahead.
I was going to say that goes exactly to knowing your role. You know, if I know my unit's an anvil and that's their job, then I know that that's the role to back up and take those charges. They don't have to, you know, I don't feel obligated to counter charge them because they have to do their damage. You know, I know that, hey, they're holding the units. That's, you know, worth at least their points in value, probably usually more. You know, as long as they're holding for two rounds, then I'm good. I'm holding, you know, that means I'm winning this charge. That means I'm opening this flank charge on them, you know, whatever the case may be. That's generally what you want to do with my list. That's how I build lists in general.
Now, you mentioned it before briefly, and I'm really curious to hear your thoughts, so I want you to touch on it a little bit more deeply. Speak a little bit too, especially now when we have Clash of Kings, which I think one of the best aspects of Clash of Kings is another set of just really fun, great scenarios. So when you're list building, are you trying to imagine or visualize how your army would work in all of these different types, like the objective scenario, the control board space scenario? Are you kind of trying to think about how your list is going to perform and be effective in those different scenarios?
I think there's two aspects to list building that to kind of tie into that. I think there's the initial list building, which is like I have an overall idea of what I want to do in my army, and you build it. I think when it comes to that aspect, you don't necessarily think, oh, well, what happened there? You know, did I do something wrong? Did I make mistakes? Or maybe just the scenario didn't do well for me. I have to look at, okay, maybe invade, I was just too slow to get across the table to fight and put it on his terms. And you know, I think that it's important to realize in the playtesting phase what scenarios are you weak at. How do you play around it? Have some kind of answer to it. You know, adjust your play. You know, if you can't adjust your play, then adjust your list. You know, maybe change a unit out that wasn't quite performing up to snuff on that scenario.
Yeah, because I think you bring up a good idea. I often get more out of a game. I can't quite drink from the chalice of victory. But when you lose, you're like, okay, why did I lose? And that's, I think, when you can turn that lens in and become introspective about what's going on and figure out, okay, well, did I not play the scenario correctly? Was it my list? And sometimes you just get outplayed, and that happens. Sometimes you just make a mistake and you get punished for that mistake. But when you're losing, I think looking at all these different elements during the playtest and tournament phase, you can kind of pick out all these points and maybe what went wrong.
Well, absolutely. I think that's the most important part about playtesting and list building, is that you have to sort of take the factors out that weren't relevant and adjust your list accordingly and kind of figure that out. And that's to me I have the most fun doing that. Like, I love losing, you know. I love going in there and getting some tea smashed and saying, okay, that didn't work. And then let me find out what I need to do to come back and beat him. You know, I'm very much a dwarf in that aspect, that I hold a grudge if I'm losing. I make sure that I'm stubborn enough to come back and find the answer and come back and beat him. So
you gotta get like a notebook, and you got to write down the names of like all the people who beat you. So
it's a mental list, trust me. It's not, I could write it if I needed to. So yeah, I got a few of the lists, a few grudges to settle. But besides that, absolutely, I think that you can learn by far the most from losing, and I think losing a lot is great. I think I lost quite a bit when I first started playing Kings of War. I think was you know, a lot of losing, and that's what makes your list stronger. That's how you kind of figure out what works and what doesn't. And I think that's, you know, if people get discouraged from that, I mean, think there's a lot of opportunity to sit back and think, okay, well, you know, let's assume that I didn't make silly mistakes, kind of knew what I was doing. How do I adjust my army to beat people? And that's, to me, I think that's the most fun in list building.
Yeah, facing adversity and playing great players is how you get better.
Oh yeah, easily. I think it's undoubtedly, and that's why I think going to GTs and tournaments in general, you get so much experience coming out of a tournament that it's not even close. I mean, a hundred times I've been like left the tournament more excited to play the next one and to play more games and, you know, do more community stuff in general. I think that's the general. Let's say, you know, it's a good tournament, I think, or you had a good time, is that you kind of leave it more invigorated and kind of ready to do more things, whether it's hobby or list building, etc.
So as we start kind of wrapping up your general philosophies on list building before we get into like the meat and gravy of your dwarf list, when you're thinking about terrain, is that influence your list building? Are you thinking about how you're going to deal with difficult terrain, impassable terrain, obstacles, or kind of how does terrain factor into your strategy when you're building a list?
Yeah, I think terrain is a very big part of Kings of War. And one of the things I really actually like, I think going into the game initially, I was pretty slow to adapt to that aspect of it. I didn't quite, one too many hinder charges later, I was, hey, maybe I need to kind of look into this. And so I think that in general, when you build your list, you absolutely need units that can deal with terrain, because otherwise, your opponents can take advantage of you very, very easily. A smart opponent will know that you're not Pathfinder and just kind of sit in terrain or kind of, you know, game your army in the sense that you can't take charges you normally would. So I think you absolutely need to build your list around it. I mean, I think Caterpillar is an item I put in almost every list, just because it's so important. I think most people use kind of the Epic Dwarf map packs, which, I mean, you're looking at about 8 to 10 pieces of terrain per table. So I think it's important to know your meta and to know what kind of terrain you're playing with when you build your list. You know, I think in general, you're going to see a lot of terrain to Kings of War, which I love. I think it's great. I think that, you know, you need to have at least 3 to 4 units that are you know, don't have any extra terrain. I think that that's a very important thing to build into your list in general. Just kind of know that okay, if I'm on a certain board, am I screwed? Or can I play around it? You know, kind of find ways to deal with it. And same thing with being boards are wide open. There can be a thing that's too much Pathfinder where all of a sudden you play an open field, your opponent's going to run right through you. I think you need to agree for both things or kind of account for both things.
Yeah, no, I think that's some good thoughts. Okay, so finally, as we kind of wrap up, I'm curious. I think this is an interesting topic. So how does hobby affect your list building? I know for me, if I've spent a month painting a horde of skeletons, that usually they're going to find a way into my list when maybe they shouldn't necessarily be in there. I mean, are you into the hobby side of gaming? How does hobbying and painting, does that influence your list building at all? Or speak a little bit about that.
Yeah, definitely. So certain units, something like that. At the same time, I generally I consider myself more of a gamer than a hobbyist. So if the unit is not performing, you know, no matter how pretty they are, I eventually would probably drop them. And that's why I think it's important to kind of play test your list before you kind of, you know, go all in on the hobby side of it. You know, I love really building units and you know, I have one unit in particular, it's a dwarf on a bear. I used it as the king of the large beast for a long time. And then I have one of those beautiful cyber models and he's great, but I haven't used them in a while. Yeah, it's so cool, right? But I haven't used them in a while. And you know, I pulled them out the other days to try them out again. I was kind of a little sad that I don't have my list. But in reality, I mean, the game, if you're trying to win, you kind of have to, I think, take a step back and look at your list and decide, you know, would I be off the unit or not and kind of go otherwise. And, you know, sometimes you'll add a unit that you end up liking even more or something. You know, there's other things that come from it. So I think that, you know, it is important to take a step back if you know, decide that you don't want the unit or if you don't like that. And I think that's most important to play test the list before you really go all in to decide, you know, that's the theme or style that you really want to play.
And that is a great thing about Kings of War is that it is really easy to play test builds. You just empty movement trays and then, bam, there you go. You can play test things.
Absolutely. I had some very ugly games before I was able to build up my army.
What they need to do is you need to start a Bear Lives Matter campaign and get them to put in some heavy bear cav, as large cav for dwarves. And then we can all purchase the Skyboard dwarf models and be happy.
I'm the biggest fan of that. I'd be all aboard that one. Yeah, I would love some large cav there. I've thought of like finding a way to put the bears in sort of, and I've seen some cool conversions of people do bears for Brock Riders. Will have a you know, kind of a multi-base unit, which I think is awesome still. But yeah, that part of the reason I started playing dwarves was for that bear model, and ended up kind of not using it anymore. So you know, that's the way it goes sometimes.
Skyboar's dwarves are just amazing. They're just, I love that aesthetic is so good.
Yeah, I'd say half my army, not half, a portion of it is Cyborg, a portion is Avatars of War Dwarves, so I like a lot as well.
Nice. Okay, Rob, do you want to maybe go with Alex and kind of take a look at the specific list he has with him?
So we've kind of covered, Alex, the, you know, general list-building philosophy. Let's get in and talk about this specific list that you're going to share with us. First step,
yeah.
Why don't you walk us through the list and you know, go through it unit by unit? And maybe quickly talk about, you know, what are the roles for each of these units? And then touch on if you have, you know, interchangeable units, like maybe you have, this is my hammer, but maybe you have multiple hammers.
Right. So I think, first of all, the list I'm have here, I've been playing this list or some variation of it for about a year, I would say. I've been tuning it that long, and it hasn't changed that much in about a year. I'd say I've altered things here and there, but this general list has kind of worked for me for about that long through just kind of playtesting and playing in various tournaments and whatnot. So for the list itself here, this is one I'm looking at here. This is kind of my newest version of it. I have two troops of Rangers, and their role is pretty multifaceted. They can do a couple things. Part of it is clearing chaff. We talked about chaffing issue. Rangers come in with 10 shots. They shoot. They have great range. They have 4-up range and 4-up melee, so they can shoot pretty well. But the thing is that once they're done clearing chaff, they're just as much a threat in combat. If I push a Ranger, you know, Rangers up and they're in a flank charge, I mean, that's 20 attacks on the flank that you're not going to take at CS1. You know, they definitely do a role very well. They count as a scoring unit now, the Clash of Kings. So they're kind of the linchpin of my army, in the sense that they can do so many different roles at once that they're very easy to overlook and very easy to ignore. In reality, they just do so much damage. And in a lot of games, they've been my MVP, where they end up killing 2 to 3 units on their own just because they've underestimated them or just didn't deal with them quick enough or something like that. So I'm really happy with two troops to range. I think that it puts a respectable amount of shooting out for a fair price. They are a little pricey for their defense. The thing is, you have to be a little bit careful with them. Generally hide them around terrain in you know, either obstacle or some kind of woods or something like that. I think with the new Clash of Kings change, they're a little bit more tough now to fireball and lightning bolt, things like that. They used to really kind of evaporate them. They're just tough enough now to kind of take a punch or two of that and still do their role. So I think they're really, really good unit to have overall. And they're Vanguard and they're Speed 5, which is really quick for my list. So that's a good unit in general. Going down, my next I have here is Earth Elementals. I have two hordes of just the infantry, the large infantry unit. They're great for a lot of reasons. Obviously, they're Defense 6. They're my general anvil units. They're great because they're Pathfinder. So they check that kind of box off. They give me a Pathfinder unit. And they have Crushing Strength 1. So they're not that... although they're defensive, they actually can pack a punch, especially if you're going to get flank charges with them. And they're also surgeable, so they have the ability to kind of threaten, you know, flanks out of nowhere or flyers try to land behind you, things like that. You can answer to those guys, you know, even if you don't use it, you know. It's one of those things that you, as long as you're threatening it, your opponent's playing differently, and that's what I want. I want him to be a little bit more cagey and defensive with his flyers instead of being aggressive all over the place. After that, I have two regiments of Brock Riders. And they're my general hammer. So these guys, you know, they have 26 attacks each. They hit like absolute trucks. I give one the brew of strength so that they're hitting with, you know, TC1, CS1. And if I bane chain them, they're going to hit with essentially CS3 with vicious, just really going to evaporate units. And then the advantage they have is that they're also a really, really high nerve. So I can throw them out there and sometimes they'll take a charge and be able to counter charge just as hard or you know, to take a hit as well. So they're although they're hammer, they kind of fill the role as an anvil. And then same with the Earth Elementals, even though they're anvil, they can be a hammer when they need to. Those units, you know, have a primary role and they're kind of a backup, you know, according to what happens in the actual game. The second unit, Brock Riders, I will run Caterpillar on just because, you know, terrain is a thing. And even though most of my army is Cat Pathfinder, I think that, you know, losing the Thunderous Charge and the plus one that, you know, you can on fives just really takes away their ability to hit hard. So I need to have an answer to you know, to can't just sit in a wood and kind of laugh at my Brock. I need to be able to charge them. Going to the characters now a bit here, I have an Army Standard Bearer with the Lute of Insatiable Darkness. 70-point character, inspires and gives me Bane Chant. Pretty much every list I make is, you know, 19-30 points with a BSB on it. I mean, first thing I take in every army for sure. Really hard to beat the value of the Inspiring and Bane Chant. You know, Bane Chant, just every unit could use it. Really strong spell in general. So only downside in that guy is only speed 4. But, you know, sometimes you just have to march him 8. And you know, if you're fishing early, I think you're just going to have to march him a little bit, kind of make sure he's in position where he needs to be in the later turns. Next, I have the Berserker Lord on the Brock. And he's got the Blade of Beast Slayer. And that just kind of makes him very, very good at fighting those large infantry, large monsters. He can pretty much reliably charge into any combat and put in 5 wounds at least. You know, if you roll well, something gets even higher. And you know, that the fact that he's a 360 charge being an individual is really, really helpful, again, to talk about flyers. You know, I think when you talk about anti-flyers, anti-shooters, it's important to realize that you can't just have one answer. The more answers you have, the better. So my individual is an answer. My surge is also an answer to flyers. You need to have multiple roles. And I've run lists without this guy, and he's immediately missed. His presence on the battlefield is so impactful. He just does so much damage. And he also has a really good nerve as well, so he can take a counter charge and not necessarily crumble the first time. You know, that guy's tell you, that guy's killed more dragons, more notches on his belt for dragons than I can even count anymore. I mean, it's a pretty awesome character in general. Next, I have the Stone Priest. And he's got Bane Chant 2. It comes with Surge 8, so he's got that, you know, built into him. And again, it's not a lot of Surge. I can't really do tricky things with it necessarily, but, you know, what I can do is I can punish my opponent if they're trying to land next to me, if they try to let me head on, and I can have an elemental that I can kind of pivot and charge into it. I can do those kind of things. I give him Bane of the Griffin, which I think is really, really strong. The extra nerve on your units, he's generally going to hang around the elementals, and I've seen some people say that you should get Bane of the Griffin to big horde units to kind of get more use out of it. I'm a strong believer in the opposite, in that I think that it's better on characters, because I feel like the big horde units are the ones that need the nerf the most, and if they have the Bane of the Griffin, they can't give it to themselves. So in general, I like to have it on characters that are going to stick by the units and give I get the nerve where I need it. If my general rule is I'm giving you Inspire, and I generally want to give you the nerve as well. So that's why I give it on him, and I've been really happy about him so far. I think it's made pretty much an impact, if not every game, almost every other game. There's a nerve roll that's really close where he matters. So pretty much we'd always take that load out the way he is now. And then round up my list, I have 3 Greater Earth Elementals, which I found to be a really good number. Really one of the MVPs of the list in general. The defense that they bring to the battlefield is just hard to beat. Defense 6, nerve dash 18. I mean, there's really, really strong for 160 points. You can't really beat that. And not only that, but being a monster, they're really easy to kind of pivot and surge into stuff. So if I have a monster that's out there, I can, and even if you charge me, I can still pivot 90 degrees. I can still move 5 inches. And I can still surge him. So, you know, he's just a really, really, really useful tool. You know, I don't have really chaff on my list, but I kind of consider my Great Elementals my chaff. So I throw them, all the first ones, I throw them out there and let the opponent deal with them, because there's no way an opponent can deal with the Great Elemental in a points-efficient manner, just too much defense to go through. So that's my list right there. It comes in about 12 drops, and it's kind of mostly defense 6, high nerve, but also some hard hitting.
Day complete, casual, friendly, beers and chips sort of list. Right, Rob?
Right.
Yeah. How much unit strength is in? Is that 15 unit strength?
Yeah, it's 15 on the dot, exactly, which is okay. It's not over the top. It's not too little. I think it kind of works. And as long as this is doing what it needs to, it's killing enough of the opponent that, you know, I don't have to worry too much about that. And then for scenarios like push or loot, I have lots of defense 6 units that can pick up tokens, and they're already slow. They don't care too much that they're slowed down, that kind of thing.
For this list, did you develop it over time? Or?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, it took a lot of tweaking. I think in general, I think when I first started list, like I said, I wanted some monsters. I wanted some Brock Riders. I had some various dwarf units. And it took a little bit of time. I played against a lot of elf players, if I'm being honest, more than anything else. So if anything, I learned how to play elves, which I think ended up being a good thing. And if you had to pick one army, I think elves is the one that you want to know how to play against. And these tools do really well against them, because you have the tough element and you have the hard-hitting unit. So it took a little bit of time to kind of tweak it. But in general, I'd say, like, you know, maybe 60% or 70% of the list I was able to kind of build, you know, off the get-go. And then I kind of tweaked it from there to get the characters right, the units, the shooting right, that kind of thing.
Yeah, I played against one of the players in our group plays dwarves. And he's not completely like your list, but a lot of the similar elements. So there was just a couple things I wanted to comment, which I love your choice of magic artifacts on your Brock Riders. Brew of Strength, I think, is great. I think Brock Riders struggle if you can get a defense 6 survivable unit in front of, and you charge the Brock Riders, or you get them in front of the Brock Riders, that Brock Rider regiment can just get slogged down for half a game. So I think having just a little bit of extra strength, and then being able with Caterpillar to maybe deploy that other Brock unit in difficult terrain or right in front of difficult terrain, so you can charge out of the difficult terrain, I think that those are some really good artifact choices for both those units.
Yeah, and that's actually, you know, what you said pretty much what led me to the Brewer's Strength. And that's something I've actually done kind of recently. At the Brewer's Strength, I like it more and more in Calgary. As counterintuitive as it sounds, you know, what it does, it really negates one of their weaknesses, like you talked about. If you can bog down my Calgary, you know, and they're hitting you with no TC back, then you don't really care. But if I have Brewer's Strength and maybe a Bane Chant nearby as well, all of a sudden this Calgary, which you didn't think that much of, is now hitting you with CS2, and that's a hell of a lot of damage usually. So it changes the dynamic quite a bit.
In many ways, ICTC is like a bonus. If you calculate too much the TC into your math on what that unit can or not kill, you can run into some challenges when you lose that Thunderous Charge for whatever reason. The game dictates you move through terrain or whatever. So I, you know, Crush, and I know Rob has talked about this before, Crushing Strength is king. It's just it's so good. And then also I think I really like, I'm in your camp as far as the Banner of the Griffin. I run Banner of Griffin on a Mounted Revenant King who sits behind a Regiment of Wraiths and a Regiment of Soul Reaver Cav. And to me, I think having it on an individual character that you then place next to the units that you want to have the benefit of rallying is really powerful. So I like your placement of that on the Stone Priest, I think is really good.
Yeah, I think it's just in general to have it. Like the ones that have Inspiring already, like the Lich Kings, the you know, the units like that have Inspiring, they have their spells they already need. They don't, you know, what items you really give them doesn't really do much until you give them a Banner of the Griffin. That kind of lets them do their role even better. You know, there's nothing else they really get that you know, can really change much. Otherwise, I would just go kind of bare bones on these guys. I think that's the way to go.
Yeah, because like you said, if they're Inspiring, you're already going to keep them within 6 inches of what you want to Inspire. So why not make their Inspiring also do something else? So you're not choosing to have them give rallying and lose giving something else. They're already giving what they're Inspiring, so why not also have them buff nerve?
Exactly. I mean, the first game I think I played, I had my opponent like roll exactly one under what he needed with the Band of the Griffin. I was like, okay, well, that M's kind of staying. You know, anytime that happens, you do its value immensely, and it's just about playing odds. You know, if your opponent needed a 5 or 6 to route you, now they need a 6 or 7. It's just that one more likely to hold, and it just makes such a big factor in the game in general.
So, what first drew you to dwarves? What was it about them that wanted you to do a dwarf army?
Well, I generally always liked dwarves. I always liked their theme and you know, the concept of dwarves. I played dwarves in other games and you know, video games, what have you. And you know, the reason I didn't play them in Warhammer Fantasy was that they were such a static army. They didn't really do much other than sit back and shoot you with war machines and kind of have a bunch of blocks of infantry. And to me, that was just kind of boring. I think it was a little bit too static. And so the second I saw Kings of War, I thought, okay, dwarves aren't the same anymore. They can play aggressive. They can play, you know, defensive. They can do both. So I just kind of saw it soon and say, you know, let me start a brand new army here instead of being a refugee, which I kind of was at the time. But I had taken enough of a break from Warhammer 8th edition that I was ready to start fresh and kind of build an army from the ground up. So dwarves just seemed kind of a natural choice because they're so different from what, you know, that other game offered.
And you bring up two interesting points that I would love for you to expand upon. One is, I wonder if the people who struggle with dwarves in Kings of War struggle because they're trying to play dwarves in Kings of War, how dwarves played in fantasy. And this, as you've hit on a couple times, this version of dwarves, it's different. They're not your grandma's dwarves. I mean, this is it's a different style list. So I was hoping that you could speak a little to that and then also talk, you know, there's lots of talk about Abyssal Dwarves and Dwarves, those lists without, like an Abyssal Dwarf list without Dwarves, Abyssal Dwarves, or a Dwarf list without Dwarves. Are there issues you see with regular Dwarf infantry? Are they still playable? Do you just not play them because you like these other things? Or speak a little bit to that and kind of the different nuances in Kings of War Dwarves versus how they were in the other game.
Right. So, I mean, my list is very much, I call it the rocks and brocks. I mean, I don't have a lot of dwarf infantry. I mean, so you can count my rangers kind of as dwarf infantry. But I think dwarf infantry is fine. It's okay to have a few units. I think there's important not to invest too much into the hordes of dwarf infantry. And I think that's what a lot of ex-Warhammer players have done and have not been successful with. The thing about dwarf infantry is you have to support them well, and you have to not run a lot of them. You can't run an army of only dwarf infantry. It's not going to work just because it's not balanced. I mean, there's no way that army works with any army. And that's, I think that dwarf players in general harp a little bit too much on the fact that their dwarf infantry isn't viable, when reality is they're okay. I have a couple of lists that run dwarf infantry that work okay. It's just, you know, you just have to balance them with other units. You still need some cavalry. You still need some characters that can impact punches, things like that. I think a lot of players are too hung up on the older style because, you know, I don't see an all elf infantry army working either. You know, there's no all Varangir infantry army that works as well. I mean, the fact is that all infantry doesn't work no matter what army it is. I think dwarfs just happen to think that that's a problem because they haven't maybe changed their armies up enough since the previous, you know, game to kind of figure out a new way to win or a new style to win. And I think that's why you see it more, you know, if you go post on Fanatics about dwarves, you'll generally see a lot of players come and defend that style of play. Like it's something that you have to preserve, something that should be viable. And it's just Kings of War. The infantry is not quite viable in this edition. You can have some of it, but it needs to be supported well and needs to not be your whole army.
And you bring up an interesting point, and they were talking about this on Unplugged Radio, that when you're looking at a dwarf infantry horde, right, as opposed to a regiment, you're measuring from the horde's leader point, so that charge distance is like you can almost not be able to charge things that are so close to you because the charge is so small, and you're measuring from the middle of the horde that, like you said, maybe regiments as far as dwarf infantry, if you are going to play some dwarf infantry, that you would want to maybe go regiment as opposed to horde because of those charge measuring mechanics.
Oh, absolutely. That's one of the saddest moments you can have as a dwarf player. I'm sure – I know Rob plays dwarves. He probably could relate to this as well, that, like, you know, I've played plenty of game with dwarf hordes where I was like, oh, okay, let me set up this perfect trap here where I can flank them with my horde, and then I go to measure and I'm 8.5 inches away or 9 inches away, and I'm like, oh, God, how is that even possible? I'm right next to their unit. So I generally would never take a dwarf horde, I don't think. They're just not ever going to be where they want to be. They're only, you know, speed is king in this game. And so, you know, if you take enough regiments, you can kind of fill the field up with enough threat zones that you'll work out. But the hordes are just, the problem is that they're going to always get charged. And when you get in charge, it means you're in charge in your opponent's terms, not yours. And that generally means that you're going to get killed in one go, or you're going to get killed in the point where you can't really do much back. So I think that once you move away from hordes, moving to regiments, there's plenty of viable dwarf infantry units out there, but it just takes a lot of learning and practicing to get those right. Elementals, Earth Elementals on the hand, are definitely a really strong unit. I think that they fill a lot of roles well because they're surgeable. They have Pathfinder built into them, and they also have some crushing. So, I mean, they're just more versatile. So to me, they made more sense to kind of build an army around it initially. But it's not to say dwarf infantry is not feasible because there's a lot of really good choices for those as well.
So are there any matchups you struggle with, either scenarios or types of popular builds in your meta? Is there anything that you see and you're like, oh, geez, like you're getting ready to fight against with this list?
Yeah, I think that the weaknesses I do have, being that my list is a little slow, is some of the faster armies out there. I'll say Abyssals have given me trouble just because they can shoot pretty well at a short range. They can kind of take advantage of the fact that I'm a little slow and shoot me up with like fireballs and things like that. And also they can come at me with a bunch of different angles that if I, you know, if I have to split my army up too much, it doesn't quite function the way I want it to, where it's kind of this big cohesive force, where this big solid anvil. If my anvil is split in half, then there's cracks that come in there where, you know, there's openings where opponent can split me out. So there's a couple elite faster lists that I've had some issues with. And I think those lists are just good in general. I think that's just something that you have to learn to play against.
Well, you've touched on it a little bit before about being adaptable and when you're deploying. With this specific list, is there any things that you like to try to – you're hoping to get done in the deployment phase with how you set your army up? Is there any sort of early combat strategies or synergies you're hoping to get? Or does it just totally depend on what's happening in the deployment phase? Or are there some things you hope to be able to get to where you want them to be in the deployment?
My general strategy is, again, like I said, I want to win the flanks. I want to have my hammer units sweep down the flanks and crush it in two turns, and then turn around and kind of, you know, envelop the army. You know, that's what I think the army does best in general. It will very much, I can count on my center line to hold pretty strongly. So as long as my flanks can be aggressive and attack my opponent, you know, if they give me the flanks, then I'll be know, very happy the second I'm deploying. I think, okay, well, this is going to work the way I want it to. And let me just kind of charge there. And then my army likes to push my models forward and just smash stuff. You know, I generally like to roll dice and you know, in the fight. So my army is very much kind of slug them up. And you know, generally I hope it comes up ahead, and sometimes it doesn't, sometimes it does. But, you know, that's the general game plan, is push models forward and kind of hope things go my way.
Cool. Do you have anything that usually is like your best performers, or maybe like a favorite unit you have on the list? You mentioned a little bit the Berserker Brock Rider Lord. Anything else in the list you really like, your Brocks maybe?
Yeah, the Brocks in general. I think the Berserker Lord is a cool, unique factor, but the Brocks in general just do so much work. They hit just the stats are more awesome. 26 attacks, the nerve dash 22. They just do so much work in general, you know, if I could take three in this army, I probably would. You know, I've had some variations. If I take three regiments of Brock Riders, I think you're fine with that as well. I think they can just do so many things at once. Like I said, they're a hammer, but they're also kind of an anvil too. So just the way you use them and the way you support them is kind of how they play out.
I think that dash 22, I mean, a lot of people talk about the Brock's offensive ability with the attacks and all that other, you know, this, that, and the other thing. But I think that dash 22 has put me out in so many games when I think about the combat strength I'm going to dictate to killing a Brock unit. And then you just, I mean, you know, it's there, you know, that's what their nerve is, but you're thinking, okay, heavy cav, a little weaker defense, but more attacks. You have a sense of what you think you need to kill them. But like you said, that nerve is just really good.
Absolutely. And it's important, you know, if you're playing, especially if you're playing like elite armies that don't have a lot of attacks. I mean, even if they do well, let's say they do like 14 to 15 damage to you. I mean, that's normally any other unit, that unit's toast. With them, you know, you could hold. I mean, you very easily hold it. And that's just something that some opponents just aren't ready to deal with, or they didn't factor in. So, you know, you use that to your advantage as long as you're, you know. I some opponents set up like this combination where they'll put their chaff in front of their calf, and I'll charge the chaff all day, kill them, and then they think, oh, okay, and I got you, I can charge you now. But if you're supportive, and maybe I've been a griffin nearby or something, you know, I can take that charge all day and then just counter charge appropriately. I mean, it's just something that you really have to take advantage of and deploy properly. One thing you'll notice as well is that the Brocks, they have defense 4, but then the rest of the army is kind of defense 6. So it's you know, if I'm playing it right, if I'm deploying properly, you're make sure your opponent's, you know, high low piercing stuff fights your defense 6, and then let's say they have a lot of high piercing units, you kind of put those against the Brock. So, you know, it doesn't matter if they come in here with CS3 dragon, you know, it's only gonna be 2s no matter what, and usually a low number of attacks. So you kind of, if you get the matchups right, then the low number of attack stuff is fighting your Brocks, and then the high number of attack stuff doesn't have a lot of piercing fighting your elementals, and then that's kind of what you want to do when you play this list in general. When I play this list.
Yeah, because like you said, I mean, to break a Brock unit with average dice, you got to do 15 damage in one turn. I mean, that's a lot of damage to put out on one unit.
Yeah, exactly. And then if they don't, then you just make sure you just punish them for it. So, you know, you make sure you can have a charge well enough to make them pay. And that's kind of things like the brew strength come in. That's why Bane Chant is such a good synergy with my list, because it's very counter-chargy. And, you know, or if I'm getting a flank charge, you make sure you have the Bane Chant ready for that flank charge to maximize it.
And like you said, that I won't ever discount that Brock Rider Lord. He went straight ahead into a regiment of Soul Reavers, wavered them the first turn, wavered them the second turn, killed them on the third turn, and he's just sitting there. My poor defenseless vampire is just getting thrashed in the face by that Mounted Brock Lord is so good.
But, exactly. The guy's killed dragons, and I played a game yesterday where he killed the regiment of tree shamblers. He hit a dracon unit in the flank, helped to waver them, and then, you know, came around, ended up killing a dragon by the end of the game. So him alone, you know, his little 170-point character essentially was responsible for killing, you know, probably excess of 700 points, something like that.
So you said it, and I know that we've talked about it before. Speed is king. So I'm curious into the different type of scenarios. Are there any scenarios that you struggle with, or what do you think about trying to be in those high movement scenarios with a slower moving army? Or just in general, speak a little bit about to what scenarios are, is this list good at? What do you struggle with?
Yeah, I mean, I found that I struggle the most with kill, and then also kill and pillage. The good news is that you don't really see those that often anymore, which is awesome for army, because generally it's slow, but I can get to where I need to be in about, you know, 6-7 turns. So As long as I'm planning ahead, you know, invade would be something you think would be bad, but my army's so aggressive that I you know, generally will find myself, I can get to the opponent's half of the table. I got to go a little further than that, then it might struggle a little bit, but so far it's been pretty okay at most scenarios. I can't really think of one that stands out as being a weakness. I'd say maybe the new one that you can burn the tokens. I think it's called Scour, I think. Is that the one where you can kind of destroy the pillage tokens? So if my army's a little too slow, if I can't, like, if my opponent's, like, smart and they're kind of quicker, they bounce between the markers and kind of burn a couple that might, you know, that might have counted and getting. But I think besides that, my army plays the scenarios pretty well, just as long as I plan ahead.
No, and I think that's one of the real kind of different things I've seen on this game than in other games is moving into a very heavy scenario-based game, and that, you know, this is no longer train on the side, let's play battle line, meet in the middle and see who wins. You know, Kings of War is very scenario-based. Which I think adds to its dynamicness. And that's why I think a lot of people who first try out Kings of War, who maybe think it's too simplistic, I don't think they've gotten deep into the scenario play yet.
Right. Scenario makes it a very tactical game. I mean, that's where I think all the tactics come in. I mean, if you plan ahead, then you're able to win the scenarios. If your opponent's just playing kill every game, then you can take advantage of that a little bit and think, okay, well, you know, I'm going to play you kill on this half of the table. Well, on the other half, I'm going to put my units there and capture these three tokens, whatever the case might be. If you plan ahead, you will get rewarded in this game about it. And I think that's what makes it very tactical. It makes it very appealing to me, at least the fact that you can kind of, you know, really outthink your opponent and plan ahead and you get rewarded for it, you know, in general.
Now, you mentioned it a little bit before, but army-wise, tough matchups, is there anything like you're looking to see, like, what are the sort of lists that you usually do? Are there any a type of list that you know you're probably going to do pretty well against?
I generally like playing elves, and that's mostly just because I know them so well that I can kind of just I know everything they can do kind of before they can do it, so I've just, that's just most comfortable for me. I think that everyone has that army that they know just so well inside and out. I think in general, I want to fight armies that are also aggressive, just because, like, I feel like I can maybe do it better, or just I have so much more dedicated to that role that I can, I can do it at a more efficient price than they can.
And have you been playing this list in the garage, at game stores? Is this kind of your hardcore tournament list? Have you been playing this in your more casual games too, or in casual games you like to, you know, take just all sharpshooters, or, you know, just do something crazy, or speak a little bit about how this has been doing in a more casual side of stuff.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, I'd say this is definitely my tournament list. This is something that I generally take to tournaments. Basement games, casual games, I tend to play in a very tournament environment. Luckily, I have, like I said, experienced opponents that you know, can play against this list and lose to it and feel okay about it. So I'm okay refining it still a little more. Like I said, I'm pretty happy with this version of the list. This is about as good as the version of the list I've made with Dwarves. I think that, you know, if you want to play casual, fun stuff, I generally look to, like, other armies, and I play that when I can. So that's generally, you know, how I get my release on that.
And I think it's good just to have more than one army, you know, so you don't get stagnant. You different, and I like to, you know, have them be different. So play different styles of army, not just a different race, but if I'm playing two separate factions, I want the second faction to play differently than the first faction, just to spice things up.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I couldn't agree more. You know, like I said, playing a fast list is probably the opposite of this, and that's why my first Abyssal list I made had at least 6 or 7 flyer units, because I wanted to see what this whole speed thing was about and get fun, have fun with that.
And I think, you know, as we continue, I think you bring up a really good point, which is, and we've touched on it earlier, is if you want to get better in wargaming, play the people who crush you, because that's how you're going to learn, that's how you're going to get better. You know, both my groups have some really tough metas. And to me, it's like, I don't mind, because then when I go to an event, a tournament, I know that I'm probably going to do okay. If I can maybe not lose all the time against, like, my really good friends, at least when I go to an event, I'll be able to keep my head above water. So kind of speaking into events, what have you taken this list to any recent events? How is it performing? Talk a little bit about how this list has done in maybe some recent tournaments.
Yeah, so absolutely. So I went to Lone Wolf GT. I know Rob was there too. Had a lot of fun there. I think I finished around I think 17th overall, something like that. So it did okay. I did a really good game day one. I finished had 4 wins, and I lost my games on day 2. So it kind of dropped a bit there. But the list did pretty well overall. I was happy with it too. It had had some tough matchups that just didn't quite go my way. I took it to Unplugged GT as well, where it did pretty well. I think a variation of this. And again, there I think I ended up getting 3rd overall. So that was awesome.
So do you think, is this kind of like a finished project? Is this always kind of a evolving list? Are you thinking of adding any units, taking away anything? Is there any stuff on your painting table or hobby table you're thinking of maybe incorporating into it?
I think the list is pretty done. I mean, like I have played this for about a year, so I think it's nearing the end of its sort of life cycle. I'm taking it to Mountaineer GT, the tournament we talked about earlier, beating West Virginia. I'm hoping to do pretty well with it there. But I think that there's really not much tweaking left to do with the list that I feel like I you know, take a unit out here and there. But that just depends on kind of what you expect to play against. I think I've been pretty happy with the list so far. I think it does pretty well. And you know, there's things to say. I mean, we talked earlier about playing in your basement. I think one thing you can do as well that's really helpful is, like, if you see any other tournament lists out there, play against that against your friends. Or you know, tell your friend to see if he can, you know, if you don't have the army, you can proxy against it and kind of learn how to play against those different army builds that you might not get experience to if you don't go to a lot of tournaments. I think that's a really helpful thing in general, because, you know, one game, even if it's, you know, it's only one game, is better than zero. So if you never play against Shrouded Realms, go pull out a Triumph Zones list that you've seen and play against it, you know, kind of get that experience. I think experience is the most important thing when it comes to knowing your army well and playing with it well.
What about hobby for this army? I mean, you've kind of got the army already built, but what's the future hold?
Yeah, I mean, I'm working on the display board for it. I mean, I think things like I kind of built another Rock Rider army. I have built dwarves on foot that would obviously take the list in a different direction, but I think that's a fun element to explore eventually. If I had them built, I probably would have tried them by now in a tournament setting, but that's something that'll be long term, probably maybe after I playing an army, I come back and try to do like dwarves on foot and kind of do a lot more of that kind of action.
When you built this army, did you build it with Kings of War specifically in mind?
Oh, absolutely, yeah, absolutely. I came back from basically from at least a 5 or 5 year hiatus from Warhammer, playing from 7th edition, kind of skipping all of 8th and jumping straight into Kings of War 2nd edition, which was, I guess, about almost 2 years ago, I want to say now, right? That's something like that.
Yeah, July 2015.
Okay. Yeah. So I played like this list. I think I built it by January 2016. So I think, you know, it's about a year and a half now that I've been playing this dwarves in general, or, you know, and I'm playing them from the ground up, learning, you know, trying every unit out, kind of playing with them a lot. So, you know, I feel like I've kind of done most of what the list can do. I'm definitely ready to try other armies and you know, just have fun in general with new combinations and new units.
Now, you did mention you use a lot of Cyborg models, a lot of Avatars of War.
Yes.
What other models are in your army?
Yeah, so I do use a lot of Manic models as well. They're at the time when I built the army, they didn't have Earth Elemental models, so I ended up using the Obsidian Golem models and just painted them to look kind of Earthish and look like they're, Earth Elementals. And then also I used some D&D models for my Greater Elementals. I found this cool, I think it's like an Earth Myrmidon D&D model that I ended up using that kind of painted to look like the rest of the army. I used Avatars of War Rangers and some Avatars of War I used them like bashing between the Manic Rock Riders and Avatars of War Berserkers to make them look, I think, you know, kind of get the theme of the army together. It looks, the Berserkers look all kind of from the same theme, and the characters are Avatars of War as well. So, yeah, there's a lot of good dwarf ranges out there, to be honest. So, I think that it's hard to go wrong with when it comes to dwarves. You can just, there's so much to pull from. I think the only thing I would say is make sure you're consistent with your, you know, model ranges. You don't want to mix too many ranges. Otherwise, they just kind of don't look proportional anymore.
Yeah, and did you mix and match any of the ranges in a unit?
Not within a unit. No, I kept the units uniform just because I think that to my eye, that would stand out too much. Maybe I'm too OCD to do that, but I wanted to make sure that the units kind of looked uniform and the theme of the army looked well. And to that, like I said, it's practically half, you know, Avatars of War and then some Cyborg stuff as well, kind of mixing there.
It's been a long evening, but we've got one final thing. Are you ready, Alex?
Yeah, go ahead.
We're going to hit you with our questioner of 10 questions. Are you excited?
Yeah, absolutely. Bring it on. It's rapid fire action.
So we'll fire a question. Just when you get hit with a question, just fire off the answer, whatever the first thing that comes in your mind. Are you ready?
Oh, yeah. Go ahead.
What's your favorite army?
Dwarves, for sure.
What's your least favorite scenario?
Kill.
What drives you creatively or competitively?
Having fun. Just generally enjoying myself.
When your opponent rolls snake eyes?
I feel bad. I generally don't like to win that way.
When you roll snake eyes?
I laugh, actually. I can't help but laugh when that happens. I think I like to have the most fun. I think that's the way to do it in this game.
What's your favorite hobby material?
Hobby material? Probably resin. I like working a lot with resin models.
What's your biggest gaming pet peeve?
Pet peeve is probably sloppy players, sloppy movement, that kind of thing. Just kind of like, I like movement that's very tight and kind of working by the book.
If you had to replace miniature wargaming with another hobby, what would it be?
Probably board gaming.
What other miniature war game would you not want to play?
Definitely Ninth Age, I guess.
If you had a romantic evening with Ronnie Brenton, what would you whisper sweetly to him?
Say, thank you for everything.
Awesome. Alex.
Thanks. Yeah, that's great.
Thanks for man.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me. Big fan of you guys. Been listening to all the casts so far, you know, and commuting here is pretty bad, so you guys make that a little bit easier.
Yeah, and just tell Mike if he can up his game a little bit, we might even bring him on.
Okay. I'll let him know that. Maybe he wins Mountaineer, you'll have him or something, right?
Exactly.
Okay, we'll do. Thanks.
Jeremy, you got any final thoughts?
No, I guess, you know, thank Ronnie Renton and just whisper to him, Bear Calf.
That should be my answer, right?
All right, well, that's going to do us tonight. And until next time, keep countercharging.
Thanks for listening. And we'll see you next time on Countercharge. Please let us know what you thought of the show by emailing us at counterchargepodcast@gmail.com, on Twitter at countercharge15, or by posting on our episode thread on the discussion forum found on manticgames.com. If you enjoy the show, you can help others find out about it by leaving positive reviews on iTunes. Until next time, keep countercharging. Music is a composition of Kevin MacLeod and is licensed under Creative Commons.
And now for some rambling from a crazy 8-year-old.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Board Game Mountain. This is my mini-series I'm starting with Outworking. He's just going to be editing it. Today, we're going to be talking about the Rat House and things like that. So, the Rat House was pretty cool when I went there. There was a bedroom and this big empty room that they thought they were going to put another table in, but we're not sure yet. I've also been working on some lizard models, so I just updated you guys on that. And the thing is, this series is going to be pretty cool and fun. It's just going to be just me. We might see War Kings show up sometimes. Yeah. This is the first episode where I just introduce what I do. And so, yeah, we're just going to do that today. If you didn't know, I am Aubrey FNUF from the Board Game Cave. I help War King review board games. You might see us review Pop the Pig if you go to his channel. We reviewed Pop the Pig. I think we reviewed another game, but I'm not exactly sure. I also did a mini video where I reviewed Luna Dice, so go check that out if you want to see me reveals on Luna Dice. Luna Dice is actually pretty cool. I'm not going to spoil it. I'm going to wait till you guys go see the video and why I'm saying Luna Dice are cool. I'm not going to spoil it. But yeah, we're going to be doing stuff like reviewing models, talking about the Rat House. I'll probably do some updating on how the Rat House is working and if, what they do with that big empty room. I'm working on a lizard model right now. It's we haven't touched it for a couple of days now, but we're planning to probably, I think we're going to, I'm going to spy working if we could try to plan it sometime tonight or tomorrow, something like that. But yeah, we have lots of models that we can review. I'm thinking if we could review some of the older models from Warhammer when it was out. And if you're brand new to Kings of War and know nothing about Warhammer, well, Warhammer was similar to Kings of War, but it wasn't cool. It was the exact same thing, except Kings of War kind of had more models, kind of, and more abilities you could do while playing, kind of. I'm pretty sure the old Warhammer didn't have, like, Warhammer didn't have any waivers or route. I'm pretty sure. I'm not exactly sure. I can't really remember because I wasn't really into it. I'm planning in this series to be doing some vlogs of the rat house that my dad's going to be posting on his channel. If you want me to do some vlogging of the rat house and have it be posted on his channel, then subscribe to Countercharge. That's all I can say. If you want me to do more vlogs, my dad better get like 500 likes. Because War King is my father, which makes me the princess. Yay! And like I was saying, since my dad is War King, then that means I'm the princess. Yes! But whatever, let's just get started. So like I was saying, if you want me to do some vlogs and then have them be posted on my dad's channel, Countercharge, then my dad better get 500 likes after this podcast timing tomorrow or the day after tomorrow. So do it or I won't do the vlogs. So if you want to see vlogs, you better subscribe and you better get 500 subscribers. You hear me? 500. Yeah, we're going to do, you know, all that cool stuff. I just hit the microphone with my head. Sorry if that made a little bit of noise, but...